Recorder.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And Bruce is here with me from sunny Oregon, right?
I think it's not yet. Mostly sunny, yeah. But yeah, sunny internally. So.
Yeah, it will be. It looks like it's going to be sun. The sun will shine this morning. So somewhere. It always does. So anyway, good morning, Bruce. How are you this morning?
Good. And yourself?
I'm doing really well. I'm, having a pretty happy life. So feeling much better than I was last week when I had actually after we talked and I was, maybe it was before that, but I had gone to the doctor and found out that I had strep throat and bronchitis.
Oh.
So that's why I've been so sick. And I guess I've been sick like that for like 3 months. So ever since before I went to North Carolina, I was sick. So that was in October. So yeah, I am, now recovering and, taking, drugs. Mm-hmm. So, and they don't seem to be affecting me much. Although the prednisone, I don't know if you've ever taken that, but it does cause some weirdness in your body when you take it.
Oh yeah. My mother-in-law had taken that for many years. So I'm familiar with that stuff. Yeah. But to your earlier adjective, I would say we're all recovering here from the delusion of the illusion of separation. So we're all in the same boat. We're all recovering.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's really interesting. Speaking of recovering and all that kind of stuff, and it has really nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. yesterday I heard a teacher, and you know, I obviously I'm here all day. I'm listening to people all day long who are talking about A Course in Miracles. And, so, you know, I've got teachers from all over, great teachers, wonderful teachers. And, you know, I get to hear lots of really good, ideas and thoughts. But yesterday I heard a teacher who, and I think is pretty well respected in a lot of A Course in Miracles world. And they said, you know, A Course in Miracles really doesn't have anything to do with enlightenment. You know, if you think you're going to be, you know, getting enlightened from reading A Course in Miracles, you know, that's not what's really going to happen. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, that is really odd to me because that seems to be, and good morning, Greg. Thank you for posting that we're on the radio now. that seems to me to be the actual only intention of A Course in Miracles is the awakening from the dream. Uh-huh. And isn't that actually enlightenment? That's my thought of what it is. And so I was surprised to hear that. And so I started looking, you know, what is it that makes me think that A Course in Miracles is about getting enlightened? And it's certain things that Jesus says, like, you know, I was a man and I saw the Christ in everyone and I became identified with God. You know, I became identified with the Christ and I remembered God. And then what could he do when he was identified with the Christ and remembering God? He knew that this was an illusion. And so he could manifest a body. He said that the body just was there because he needed it to use it. And so he made it to use it wherever he needed it. And this is my take on it. He was able to go through torture and crucifixion with no suffering and no pain because, you know, to me, his body was an illusion and he knew it. And it wasn't like, oh, it's not hurting me. I'm going to pretend it doesn't hurt because I'm pretending it's an illusion. He actually knew that. And so, you know, he didn't have the suffering, the pain and the fear that came with this, whole enlightenment type, or life type situation. And, you know, he did in the Bible walk on water. He did in the Bible heal the sick and raise the dead. And in chapter 5, he says to us, the reason that you cannot heal the sick and raise the dead is because you think that there is an order of difficulty in miracles. And so the whole teaching of the course is to say, there are no levels, there are no differences, everything is the same, there is no, this world of matter and material is a dream, and if you wake up from the dream, you're no longer subject to the world of matter and material. You're no longer subject to death. You're no longer subject to sickness. You're no longer subject to all these different things. And, you know, we can't see, you know, because we think, well, he died, didn't he? You know, Ken Wapnick, he died, didn't he? No, that was an illusion. The person, the being who he is, never changed, never died, never was that being. The being that he was never was the person in the world. And
just as we have never been the dream figures that we see reflected in the mirror and that people, you know, refer to us as individual characters in, you know, dream figures and in our dreams. I was just going to say your comment about the other person who was talking about, you know, reading the course doesn't lead to enlightenment. I would say that's correct, but practicing, I would say reading and practicing the recommended ideas within A Course in Miracles absolutely does.
Yeah.
But that's why it says it's A Course in Miracles, not The Course in Miracles, because it also says that there are thousands of ways to achieve the same thing, and you know, the form isn't important. It's the content in the mind that's important, and that's why, you know, we're very fortunate to have this incredibly, you know, streamlined, you know, Warp 9 kind of classroom curriculum that is designed to save us literally countless lifetimes, but it doesn't mean that we won't eventually all get there, because we'll all figure out eventually that you know, like Charlie Brown having the football pulled away every year by Lucy, eventually we'll say, you know, that's not working out for me so well. I think I'll try a different approach to life. And which is really, you know, choosing the ego's propaganda. And it's just, and you know, when we do that and then realize that's not working, we choose against that, and we choose not to identify with the seemingly separate selves and their agendas, you know, which are always in conflict and opposition and polarized, which is why they can never work. We have, if the enlightenment for all of us is inevitable, so that's kind of nice. but why not take a, you know, a more direct route rather than a shall we say unscenic route, because the route of ignoring the unconscious guilt and saying, oh, I'll deal with it later, you know, eventually we will, because it'll keep coming up again and again until we you know, look at it and release our identification from the cause of it in the mind. But why not consciously and proactively address it as the things arise? And I think that's at the heart of what A Course in Miracles is asking us to consider doing as a routine practice, until it just becomes automatic and we generalize and suddenly after still not a, you know, a overnight process, but you know, and in a relatively much shorter period of time, we discover that we have, you know, it's, quote unquote, become enlightened by, you know, a consistent practice of the forgiveness A Course in Miracles suggests, and obviously we're all in that same boat together. We're all learning how to do that together. So I think that's why it's wonderful that we can, you know, share what we're finding helpful, and so in the last few weeks, Lynn and I have been reading from Gary Renard's fourth book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions, has been certainly helpful to me, and I think it has been for you.
It has, and it's very cool and fun, and
yeah.
Love, and I'm going to be interviewing both Gary and Cindy in January to talk about this, so I'm excited about that as well.
Great.
And you know how I love Gary Renard. You see, I changed my my picture on Facebook to a picture of us, me and Sandy and Gary from, I guess it must have been about 2007 or 2008, but we all look so young. It's crazy. Of course, I'm blonde, and he's got brown hair, and now he's blonde, and I have dark hair. So thank you, Miss Clairol. But I don't know how he did it, but who knows. But, you know, what I was going to say about all of that is, you know, so many people who are on the you know, this non-dual path and thinking all these, you know, thoughts and looking at these teachings still are under the impression that there are levels. And levels, level confusion is probably the most insidious teaching or a thing that causes so much confusion. And, you know, I look at it like, okay, you have a ladder. Okay, and the ladder you can use to reach the roof. But if there's no difference, there's no levels, then the roof is not at a different level than the ground. And the ladder itself is just a symbol. If you stack it up as if it was a different level, then you have to climb up. But if you lay the ladder flat on the ground, all the rungs are in the same position. There is no level. Mm-hmm. There's no order of difficulties in climbing it. You just walk across it.
Right.
Or like a spiral. You see these spirals that come up to a point like a little cone, and it's not. If you look at it from the above the battleground and look down at it, it's just a spiral, and it's flat, and you're just moving inward toward the truth or outward toward, you know, everything. Doesn't matter, because it's all the same level. And, exactly. You know, once I got that, you know, it's not it's not that, you know, I'm progressing the ladder and I'm, you know, learning more about, although there is, you know, a ladder of prayer and, you know, there are symbolic ladders, but, you know, it's really not, you're not really going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You're just returning to your own mind,
yeah.
Your own morality.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that geometric metaphor, you know, like the spiral and helices and that kind of things. Because I've had a lot of fun with that over the last few decades, you know, looking at geometric metaphors. And the conclusion I came, and which really was in large part a significant part of the motivation for writing the second book that I did, the Geometry Code, which really is more of a miracle studies book that started out as a geometric symbolism book. I started looking through all these different really cool symbols that have become known as, you know, sacred geometry archetypes, and was thinking about, well, how do these relate in the context of pure non-duality? Because, you know, during the time that I was first exposed to A Course in Miracles back in the mid-70s and finally picked it up in the mid-80s, you know, I was going back and forth through a lot of different metaphysical and spiritual studies and kind of the spiritual buffet line kind of thing. And one of the things that I gravitated to was what was become known as, has become known as sacred geometry. And the first book I wrote on that was all, you know, like about 1,300 different geometric patterns, if you count all the different variations in the margins. And I had a lot of fun doing that. And I realized that the principle of interconnectedness was really at the heart of, you know, what's become known as sacred geometry, popularized by folks like Adrienne Melchizedek and one of his students, Greg Braden. And I studied under Greg a little bit in a different capacity. But that was following, you know, an interest when I first went to college. You know, I found this thing about the golden proportion and the golden ratio, and just basically exhausted the UC Davis campus library at the time when, you know, long before the internet, and anything I could find on the subject, and found, wow, that's the principle that seemed to be holding those, you know, ideas together was the principle of interconnectedness. And the golden ratio really is a proportion that is a great metaphor for interconnectedness, because the ratio of the large to the small is the same as the whole to the large, and that gets expressed as what's called the golden ratio or the golden section, and it really ties into the idea that everything is interconnected. Well, what's the purpose of interconnection? Ultimately, to learn that we're all one. And that, to kind of, I'm actually working back to your topic of level confusion. So, So in a sense then, what that became is a building block in the foundation of my understanding that, you know, these symbols, can be used to either bring us to a greater awareness of the oneness that we all share through the mechanism of shared interest and interconnectedness, or, the default propaganda mode of the ego is basically say, well, this is different and that's different and I'm different from you and you're different from me and everything different from everything else. But maybe there's some ways that we can, you know, kind of get our needs met, you know, and usually at the expense of someone or something else. But that's just, you know, the silly approach that the ego thinks that there has to be something in the world that's going to make us happy. It's all based on that premise, but the principle of the truly interconnected awareness really has to rest on the premise that ultimately there's an essence or a spirit that we all share that is completely outside of and independent of space and time and duality and individuality. I like how the word individuality has the word duality in it, because it's kind of a clue there. So once we can get past that, and begin to see that, you know, that's just a silly misconception, we begin to start generalizing that, and we can generalize by looking at the level of confusion issues that come up in our lives and say, you know, just like you're saying, Lynn, you know, the ladder is really just a metaphor. And I think it's helpful to have those metaphors seen in the context of our inner kindness teacher, a.k.a. Holy Spirit, because those geometric metaphors, like a ladder, can help us avoid the fear of awakening abruptly. Because I think most of us, if we, you know, realized I think it was Gloria Wapnick who did an exercise many years ago in one of the Foundation for A Course in Miracles workshops where, you know, it was asked, you know, if there was a button that you could press for instant enlightenment, would you press it? And you know, ask for a show of hands. And I think there's one or two hands in a large room went up kind of thing. Because, no, honestly, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, most people do not want to have suddenly everything that, you know, their world seems to accord them taken away, but we're not asked to do that. We're not asked to have this, you know, you don't, the Course says you don't have to be afraid that you'll be abruptly hurled into reality. And so, you know, we have the forgiveness process that seems to take a long time, but in the cosmic scheme of things is very quick. But it just gently and easily helps us release our investment in a fraudulent identity we call ego that just doesn't really work for us. But it's done with tremendous grace and in a perfection that we couldn't have planned any better had we tried. And so, you know, the point is to get this part of ourself out of the way that wants to take over and do it in an independent way, which is, again, that same ego, and just say, yeah, well, maybe I'll try some of that. But it takes practice and mindfulness and consistency to, you know, seem to go up a ladder in our mind that we can find that isn't challenging and threatening, you know, any and it basically in a way that it saves us from needless excess fear and really minimizes the amount of backtracking and the backlash effect when ego wants to retaliate and with all of its resistance and so forth. So I've rambled on for quite a bit.
That's very good. And I just wanted to add to that because obviously I always do.
I appreciate that.
But the fear that comes about, you know, this is what, you know, we're concerned about is that you think, you know, that you, if I accept this, that I won't even know my children anymore. The things that I love in this world will be gone from me. People depend on me. What will happen to them if I'm suddenly not engaged in the dream anymore? And, you know, that is a fear that is absolutely needless because as Jesus tells us very clearly in the course, the script is written. It's going to go on. No matter what happens to me as far as my consciousness goes, if the script and the character in the script, Lynn, is the mom and the, you know, the one who's cooking beans right now, and I'm cooking beans, by the way, but I have them on low, so they're not going to boil over. The one who is, you know, doing the things that are being done here, you know, that's not going to, you know, I'm not going to abandon my children. That's not going to suddenly disappear. That's not going to suddenly be no longer, because it's still a part of the script, and there's still, you know, investment of the dreamer in the dream, that is, you know, I don't know how it works. Honest to God, I have no idea how it works. I like to think about how Jesus must have been if he was in that state of mind. I didn't see him withdraw from the world. I didn't see him say, no, I'm no longer here, so I will not heal the sick or raise the dead, or I won't talk to you about what I'm thinking. You know, Jesus didn't have any withdrawal from the world, even though I believe he was fully enlightened. He was fully awakened. He had the divine knowledge of his own true self, but he didn't withdraw from the world or abandon the world. He continued, even through all the horrific things that seemed to happen, to demonstrate to us that it meant nothing. That's the whole point of it, was to demonstrate it had no meaning. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, of course, what is the first thing we do? Oh, it has a meaning, and that meaning is important. And if I don't, you know, honor this, then I'm dishonoring it. And, you know, we have all these ideas in our mind about it. But the truth is, you know, nothing happened. You know, is this not the truth? Nothing happened. Nothing is happening. And so, you know, to be able to wrap your mind around that is impossible. But to see that there's nothing to fear. Nothing is, you know, no one's going to, you know, not get fed because Lynn suddenly got enlightened and the beans are cooking. You know, the body of Lynn probably is going to get up and go down and, you know, shut the beans off and put onions in them or whatever. But, you know, the being of Lynn doesn't have to be involved in that. That's not, it's all a part of the dream. I don't have to be a part of the dream. I don't have to be involved in the dream, and I don't have to believe the dream. I don't have to be afraid of the dream. I don't have to worry about the dream. I don't have to make the dream work. It's not my responsibility. I have nothing to do with it. It's moving along in its own pace, along with all the rest of it. It's just rolling out, and there's going to be a time when we're going to turn and look and see it all rolling back up like a carpet, and it will be no more. But that doesn't, I mean, that's not happening. You know, that didn't happen to Jesus. Jesus didn't, you know, suddenly forget who his friends were or lose his mind about, you know, what to eat. You know, he was still here as a figure in the dream, as to guide us. So, you know, I don't have a fear of that. I mean, it's not going to destroy. You know, people think, oh, I have to leave my family and go up on a mountain or, you know, whatever. You don't have to do anything. You just have to accept that the Christ is what you are, and the Christ is what everyone is, and the Christ is everything, and it's the only true thing and the only real thing. And if you can just accept that and then look for it everywhere, you never stop looking for the Christ, because when you look for it, you will find it. And that's my experience, Bruce. I truly am experiencing a almost ecstatic feeling almost every day of just incredible joy, because I see that beyond this world is a world I want. Mm-hmm. And it is a real world, and it is a beautiful world. And, you know, if I cannot be concerned with the world and just let it be and let God take care of everything, and stop trying to be the God in charge, I can see the truth. I can see peace instead of this. All these lessons make total sense from that point of view. But from the point of view where I think I need to do something, those lessons are awful. They make no sense. And they cause a lot of fear. So, right. Anyway.
Yeah, I think to tie into what you just said and hopefully, wrap a ribbon around it, I think there's a section in the manual for teachers that summarize that very nicely, which is, are changes required in the lives of God's teachers? And since we're all teachers and students of this curriculum of undoing the ego, otherwise we probably wouldn't be talking and or listening right now, that's a pretty important reminder that it's never about the form, nothing so blinding as perception of form. It's always, or the behavior, so we don't have to move or, change life partners or get a different job or, change our diet or other lifestyle kinds of, modifications. None of that's required. Certainly, if you're drawn to live in a cave or a monastic community or whatever, more power to you. But that's kind of missing the point is that if it's changing something in the dream, if we just need to, recognize how easily the ego wants to put on the dream repair technician hat and say, oh, I'll just fix this dream situation. And then, by changing the effect, the cause will change. Well, no, it doesn't work that way. It's always and only about the mind. And then we just have to change our thoughts about the world, and recognize that that's where the change happens. And that to all outside appearances, to, other people in the world, there may not be a whole lot of change going on in the lives of Lynn and Bruce and whoever else is studying and practicing this curriculum. And sometimes there are, but that's not where the change is happening. It's changing in the mind, not changing in the outer circumstances. So, for example, last night, my wife and I went to, along with a friend and neighbor, a Christmas concert here on the Oregon coast, and it was very nice. And at first I was starting to think, well, there's a lot of religious music, certainly as you kind of might expect going to a Christmas concert. And just for a few seconds, I started thinking, well, yeah, I don't really need this, but I really got into the spirit of what was shared and the inspiration behind some of the music, and some of, most of it was actually very lovely. And I, for a number of times, just closed my eyes and just let the harmonies wash through me. And I begin to notice the spiritual essence of all the people, not just up on the stage, of which there are about 50 people in the choir and a few musicians, but everyone in the room. And it was just, kind of this wonderful mystical experience. But I think that's what we're encouraged to do by looking at beyond the form. Doesn't mean that the form goes away. In fact, the form was, a part of that. It wasn't necessary, but I used it as a mechanism by choosing the teacher of inclusion to realize that everyone there had the same purpose. And maybe not on the level of form, but in the mind that, we're all in this together. And it was a lovely expression of that shared interest and the harmony that I felt, not just physically and acoustically, but inwardly, was just kind of a nice reminder that we're all in this together.
Yeah, and that purpose, shared purpose. Purpose is meaning, lesson 25. Mm-hmm. And right there, that's what it's talking about, is that once you recognize that no matter what the action, what the reaction, how people think, what they say, none of that has anything to do with their purpose. That only has to do with the ego mind construct of the dream. The purpose that they all have is the same purpose we all share. Mm-hmm. And so if you can join with them in that shared purpose, and that takes forgiveness, actually, to be able to look at a person, no matter, if they're, an orange guy with crazy hair, or if they're
a hairy guy with crazy oranges.
Crazy. Or a nun in Calcutta that's taking care of orphans, or they're Charles Manson or, you know, whatever that appears in the world, that they're not, that's not their purpose. You know, their purpose is not to take care of orphans. Their purpose is not to, their purpose is to be the Holy Son of God. And when we join with them, and music is really good, it is because it connects the physical body to these harmonies, these vibrations that, that do open it. And music opens me up tremendously, and that's why I play so darn much music here, is because I see how it helps the heart to flower and open, because we connect on that vibrational level. And meditation for me is really big. And it's not just, you know, sitting, you know, contemplating or sitting with my eyes closed. You know, I do focused meditations that are actually through the Oneness University, Oneness teachings, that are actually intended to connect us, to connect me to my brothers. And so when I'm meditating, you know, we do these things like, you know, think about a brother who has harmed you and look at them in, you know, through these eyes and see that, you know, that they are one with you and be grateful for them for their contribution to you. You know, join with them in this loving place. And when you consciously, when I anyway, consciously join with a brother through this desire to know them, to love them, forgiveness just comes. It just, all that crap just falls away. And I am able to see the truth, or closer to the truth of what they are. And when I see that, reflects back to me, and I feel, I see that more of myself as well. So it causes a gentleness to come about. This is why the teachers of God are gentle. It's, you know, nature. Because once you see there's nothing to fear, there's nothing to defend or attack, then gentleness is the only way. And, you know, I see that in you. You're a very gentle person and very accepting person. And, you know, I think that's, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, I've never had a conflict with you. I can't imagine it. It doesn't seem likely in any way at all, ever, you know, and I can't imagine anything, and I'm not going to try to, but, but, you know, that gentleness reflects, people see that. And they're attracted to it, and they want to be with you, and they want to know you. And when that happens, then that opens a channel for communication. It's healing is joining. That's it. Mm-hmm. The healing of the world comes from joining. And anyone can do that at any time. There's nothing to stop you. Nothing to stop me, I should say, from joining with you in love, no matter what it appears. So, no matter if you are an orange guy, you know, I still see, I mean, I do absolutely see, you know, the beauty of that being and the desire of that being to bring rightness to the world. In, you know, I may not agree with what rightness means, but I do see that that's the only desire they have. That's the only purpose anyone has, is to bring peace into their world. And, you know, no one wants chaos, no matter how much it may seem that. No one wants chaos. They all want to be healed. Everyone wants to be healed. And that's our purpose. Our purpose is to heal this dream. And that's what we're here for in this situation, is to heal the world. So heal yourself by including and not excluding.
Exactly. So when you're talking about the orange guy, I presume you're referring to Buddhist monks, and you were just mad about saffron. Is that?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, okay, eating too many carrots. Yeah, it's the carrot thing there. Beta carotene.
There you go. Yeah. Not David Carradine. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay.
So how about if I read the first? Half portion of a paragraph and full paragraph on page 26, which is the Roman numeral 26 in the author's note in Gary's fourth book. That sounds good?
Okay, I read the whole paragraph before if you want.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I'll back up to page, that'd be 25. And the bottom paragraph starts, "The dream is not being dreamed by somebody else. There is nobody else, only the projection. If anyone or anything in this world has the power to hurt you, it's because you've given it that power. Again, this is always and only talking about the mind. Now it's time to take that power back and put the power of belief where it belongs, in God. Over time, this changes everything. The Course says, miracles are habits. Your mind is being retrained to forgive instead of judge. And then he goes on, as for your experience, you can get to the point where the world cannot hurt you. As the Course says about the Holy Spirit's form of forgiveness, quote, it denies the ability of anything not of God to affect you. This is the proper use of denial, end quote. And then he says, by being a cause instead of effect, you are reversing the thinking of the world. Now forgiveness is justified. If all of this is real, then forgiveness is not justified. All of this being the world of space and time and bodies and personas and individuality, right? And it's the thought that system of behind all that craziness. But if it's your projection, forgiveness is totally justified. The more you get used to looking at the world as not coming at you, but coming from you, the more impossible it becomes to react to it the way you used to, and the more you realize that you're dreaming. So that's from the top of page 26 in Gary Renard's fourth book, The Lifetimes, When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, History of Mighty Companions. This is from the Roman numeral 26, a note from the author about A Course in Miracles, which Lynn and I have been reading from for a few weeks now.
for the first few pages. But you know, this is exactly what we were just saying. I mean, we could have just saved 20 minutes. But, you know, I like to say it in my words. But it is the same thing. It's when you realize that, you know, this world is just coming from me, and whatever I see, you know, whatever it is I think I see becomes a Tootsie Roll to me. It really is my own mind. I'm making it up. And, you know, when I realize, which I do quite often, it's like, oh, my God, you know, did I do that? Not because, you know, I'm blaming myself for things that I see, but because I'm marveling at the inventiveness of this squirrely little thing that thinks somehow it can fool me. And, of course, the only reason it can fool me is because I gave it everything. I said, oh, you know, I won't believe this, or I can't do this, or I don't know this, or, you know, whatever. And I've set myself up to be ignorant so that I could be fooled. Because this, what we see here, is so transparent. When you really look at it and realize, oh, it's all symbols. You know, it's not even real. So, yeah. Interesting. So,
well, the next paragraph, I think you will particularly relate to, because I know you've had involvement in what's about to be discussed.
Oh, yeah, and exactly.
I read ahead a little bit.
Okay, so I'm going to read that. In 2003, shortly after the release of my first book, The Disappearance of the Universe, I started an online study group at Yahoo about my book and A Course in Miracles. It has gone on to become the largest course study group in the world. Yes, and we have over 5,000 people, and I'm telling you what, we have purged those too. We've gone through and taken out people who were not active or not participating, or emails didn't work or whatever, and still have, God, I can't even think, I can look right now, you know, over 5,000 people, and more people coming every day. So it's huge. And it actually is a study group. We do discuss the course. I post the lesson every day. People discuss their experiences. It is a tremendous learning place. It helped. It was for me. I wasn't there in the very beginning, but later on I was the next year. So okay. At the group,
I just want to acknowledge your contribution there, Lynn, because for people that don't know, I haven't been active in that group for a few years, but I was for you know, several years, and found tremendous insights being shared there, and I plan to get back to that too, because I know there's a lot of stuff that I've missed that is really wonderful. But yeah, you're referring to the DU discussion group on Yahoo, and a lot of great stuff going on there. So anyway, thank you for all, you know, on behalf of many, many people over many, many years for your contributions to that. So.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and Aussie Marie Richards and Lucia Espinoza and Marcy Colrath and and I mean, there's a bunch of people that have been Mikey Lemieux. There's a lot of people who have been actively involved in the group over years and have done, I mean, just tremendous teaching and learning. I can't even begin to say all the miracles that have happened to me because of that group. So so I will continue. And it is the Disappearance of the Universe on Yahoo if you want to join us. We at the group, we coined a phrase for forgiveness opportunities. We started to call each one a JAFO, J-A-F-O, an acronym for Just Another Forgiveness Opportunity. The phrase is born of the fact that there will always be forgiveness opportunities as long as you appear to be here. However, it's possible to get to the point where these forgiveness opportunities cannot affect you. When that time finally arrives on your spiritual path, these JAFOs will be less challenging and your forgiveness will be more and more automatic, leading to a major change of experience. And that's been for me, absolutely.
Yep. A lot of people can relate to that.
Yeah, forgiveness, I mean, it offers me everything. And Jesus tells me that, and, you know, when, if you have resistance to forgiveness, it's because you don't understand what it is. It's like being at the, you know, being on the Titanic, and the Titanic is sinking, and you look out and you find a rowboat, and you say, oh, I'm afraid to go get on that rowboat because this big boat is bigger and more, helpful to me, but the big boat is sinking and sinking. Excuse me. And I'm afraid to get on the rowboat. Forgiveness is the rowboat. Jump off the damn ship and get on the rowboat. You're going to, it's there for you. And it's not going to hurt you.
Yeah. And to kind of maybe optimize that metaphor a little bit, it's a rowboat that has infinite capacity. And it only appears to have a finite capacity when we're not looking at it properly. But as we get, you know, closer to it and hop on, we realize that it literally encompasses and includes everyone. And you know, DiCaprio and Kate Winslet and everybody. I mean, the whole crew's all there. You know, everything and everyone throughout all of space and time is there. So,
exactly. And we're all safe, complete and total. But right. You know, as long as you're on that sinking ship, you will be in terror. It's when you recognize that I can forgive, and this will be gone. It's no longer there. So it is the greatest thing ever. Excuse me.
So rather than their ego approach, which is always to rearrange deck chairs on a hallucinated ship that never sailed, but we're convinced that we've been on for some time, but has already sunk in truth, but we still, you know, breathe life into the idea that we're still on this phantom ship, you know. The real life raft is happily carrying us home, and we just need to shift our awareness and realize that we're actually on this life raft, using that metaphor.
Exactly. And still today, still this very day, there are people who are saying, if only they had done this on the Titanic, if only they had done that on the Titanic. You know what? They didn't. You know, if only I had married Joe instead of Rick. If only I had finished college. You didn't. You're here now, this place. And here where you are now is the perfect place for you to be. It's the only place you can be. So stop trying to activate the past. Bring it into the now and use it to project a future. Recognize that there is no past, there is no future, and the only thing that is this now, and get on the damn door. You know, jump in the rowboat. This is where you are. And anyway, enough Titanic. Anyway, do you want to go into the next paragraph?
Sure, sure. Okay. I'm often asked at various questions at my workshops about what the Course means, and I usually start off by saying that the best way to know what the Course means is to go by what it says. That may seem obvious, but the Course says a lot of things people don't want to hear, and there's tremendous psychological resistance to getting it. No kidding. That's probably one of the biggest understatements around.
But we
need to, you know, gently at our own rate, in our own way, on our own apparent time, you know, undo our investment in this titanic dream and shift to the infinite life raft and recognize that rather than going down with a ship that never sailed, we can go home in sometimes even in relative style, but certainly comfort, inner comfort, to the place we never left, right? Okay. So, for example, it says, there is no world. This is the central thought the Course attempts to teach. And that's a pretty potent quote there. Most people don't want to hear that. They want the world, and they desire the things in it they are attracted to, hoping at the same time that the bad things won't come to them, or at least not be too bad. Yet the Course also says, with the voice of the Course, Jesus speaking in the first person, I once asked you to sell all you have and give to the poor and follow me. This is what I meant. If you have no investment, and I'll add the parenthetical adjective mentally, in anything in this world, you can teach the poor where their treasure is. The poor are merely those who have invested wrongly, and they are poor indeed. And again, it's the mental investment. It's our identity investment in a dream world that gets us in all the mischief that seems to happen. The Course is talking here about your psychological investment. Okay, well, good. I knew he was going to clarify it. I didn't need to jump in. Its teachings are always done at the level of the mind, not at the level of the physical. You prepare yourself to go home by undoing the ego and gradually letting the Holy Spirit become the dominant force in your mind, and in the end, the only force in your mind.
And isn't that scary?
To the ego, absolutely. That's
I'm
the
going
greatest
to be
fear.
My drone. I will become an automaton for the Holy Spirit. I must only speak what the Holy Spirit says to me. Yeah, duh. Huh. Why would you want to say anything else? You know?
But that's another interesting point you bring up, Lynn, because the ego is afraid of being at the mercy of, you know, some force outside of itself. Well, yeah, because the force that it cannot even comprehend, let alone, you know, assess accurately, is that there is a will that is outside of the ego's wishes. And that's why the Course distinguishes between will and wish, among many other linguistic distinctions for the benefit of the students of A Course in Miracles, because the ego's wishes are always to have not only the dream world be different than it is, which it basically is the purpose for which is basically to keep us miserable, thinking that somehow changing the appearance of the dream figures and characters and props and scenery in the dream is going to make the dreamer happy. Well, no, it's waking up from the dream is going to make the dreamer happy. but the ego does not want to go there. The ego does not want to look at the aforementioned phrase in this last paragraph. There is no world. This is the central thought the Course attempts to teach, because that basically is the big game over that flashes on the screen of ego's mental arcade. But we don't have to worry about that happening all at once. It's a gradual process that we have occur by consistent, generalization and practice of the ideas of A Course in Miracles, and realizing that, wow, I'm not at the mercy, but instead I can be merciful by applying you know, and accepting the will of God, which is not anything different from the will of the true self that I am, capital S, and the true self that you are, capital S, and the true self that everyone in this world and everyone listening, capital S, is which is the same self. That will is always for seeing peace instead of the ego's interpretation, and seeing, you know, that we're not upset for the external reasons that the ego posits, but instead we're except because we've chosen to identify with dream figures instead of identifying with the dreamer of the dream. So
exactly.
Want to read the next one?
I'll go ahead and read the next one. It's got a nice long thing from Shakespeare here, so I love it. and it is, you know, I was thinking when you were talking, it's like you're drowning in the ocean, but it's the only life you know, and so you're going to fight and struggle and fight and struggle and fight and struggle, but then, you know, you suddenly realize that you can breathe water, that there is no difference between water and air, and that you are the same thing, and there's no, all that struggling was just waste of time. This is for nothing, because everything that is real is never changed. Nothing happened. It's such a relief to know that we can breathe water, you know. although the
sounds
body
a little fishy. Sounds a little fishy, but I get the metaphor.
I was spitting out a few minnows there. Anyway, so the next paragraph. The world we once believed in is a dream and nothing more. William Shakespeare, who according to my teachers was enlightened, was right on the money when he wrote these words in The Tempest. And the words are, "You do look, my son, in a moved sort, as if you were dismayed. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels are now ended. These our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into the air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, ye all which it inherit shall dissolve." What the heck? I just switched pages there. "Ye all in which it inherit," excuse me, "shall dissolve. And like this unsubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little self is rounded with a sleep." That is so beautiful. And I guess that's at the end of The Tempest. He's saying, you know, look, this has all been a dream. You know, all these things dissolve and there's nothing here. And that sounds enlightened to me, for sure.
You know, I had the privilege of hearing this performed by the folks in Ashland who put on the Shakespearean and other wonderful productions, Ashland, Oregon, a number of years ago. Just actually shortly after I started picking up the course and had picked up Gary's first book. And he mentioned this in his previous books about Shakespeare being enlightened, and he quoted also from The Tempest, not this one, I think, but it was a different quote. But it was like, wow, suddenly it was like that totally opened up my experience of that. So when family came to visit, we went to go see The Tempest at the big open air theater in Ashland, Oregon, and saw this performed. It's like, oh my gosh, look at that. The profound meaning behind some of these was beginning to be, you know, revealed to me. And not that it was like, you know, irrelevant before, but it's like it just had a depth and a perspective for me that I didn't realize. And you know, where he's basically saying, you know, all of us are being shown to be actors in a dream world, but, you know, that the spirit of the ego is melted into air, into thin air, and it's baseless. And, you know, these all dissolve and are insubstantial, leaving not a rack, not even the foundation. You know, you know, everything's been cleared out of this dream when we're complete with our forgiveness classroom. And it's just a matter of waking up. We don't have to do anything. We just have to shift our inner teacher and that suggests that we, you know, gently, persistently suggesting that we wake up from a dream that doesn't serve us. So anyway, he goes on. Those words would fit very comfortably into the text of A Course in Miracles. The Course leads to lucid dreaming on a whole new level. Eventually, you become aware that you're dreaming. Every JFO, which is just another forgiveness opportunity, is equally forgivable. You begin to relax. Real peace of mind is yours. Ironically, you function better in the dream because you can think more clearly. And you have the guidance and inspiration of the Holy Spirit to lead you. And I think that's a good point, too, is not that the goal is to be better in the dream, but that's often a byproduct, because when we're not constrained by the ego's very limited and, you know, circumscribed range of potential ideas and options that it says is okay, you know, the Holy Spirit will lead us to things that minimize the discomfort, minimize the suffering, because that's not its goal. If we're suffering, it's always really because we've chosen the wrong teacher. And it doesn't mean that we should beat up on ourselves if we find ourselves in a situation that seems miserable, either physically or mentally. It just means that, okay, I still have more work to do. I have more forgiveness classroom exercises to put into practice, and I need to listen to that inner teacher of kindness that's gently reminding me that I can wake up.
Yes, and it's a shift in perception. You know, this is what I think people don't realize. A miracle is a shift in perception. Mm-hmm. It's not that we change anything, that there's anything moved or changed. It's just that we see it differently.
Exactly.
And, you know, I resisted for so long because, you know, I thought, you know, how can I see this differently? You know, it seems so obvious to me what it is. That idea the ego has that it knows is really it makes it difficult to see this, because you're always thinking, you have this hard wall that says, this is whole, this is here, this is the way it is. And one of the things that really helped me, I was thinking from the Course and from my own understanding that it was a matter of denial, which, you know, Jesus does say, you know, deny the falsity and see the truth. But it's really not denying anything. I think when I found the work of Byron Katie, it really opened something up for me, because of that very first question that she always asks, is it true? And what I began to realize is that my belief about what truth is was the thing that was holding me back. My belief that, yes, of course it's true, you know, babies shouldn't die. Of course it's true, you know, the global warming shouldn't be happening. Of course it's true, you know, everyone should go to college. You know, I had all these preconceived notions in my mind about what should be or what I thought the world was. And that was what was keeping me from seeing the truth of this. So once I recognized that, you know, is that true? Well, there's a question. And when I start questioning my thought about what reality is, then all of a sudden I started seeing, no, it's not true. No, it's not true. No, it's not true. None of this is true. it really, and that's what Katie did. You know, she saw that nothing that she thought was true and real, and she became awake because of that. That's all Jesus is telling us. Look at this. Look at it with me. I brought you a lamp. I'm standing here at your door, and I have a lamp. I've seen that picture with Jesus, and we're going to use that lamp to dispel all these thoughts that you have. And that's all we're doing. We're dispelling our beliefs with the lamp of truth. And when we do that, of course we see it is a dream. It's not true. So
instead of being bugged by the world, we can do what Katie did, right? How's that for
yes,
music?
I knew you were going to say it, Katie did. I love you. Okay, so let's see. Did we get to these words? That was the one you just read?
Yes. So, okay. If you want to read the next one, it starts with the review. To review the first step in forgiveness. Yeah.
Yeah. Which you know, you what, yeah. Say no more.
before you do though, have you mentioned something that always triggers a reminder that of a cool metaphor? And in fact, I think there's it's such a great one. I put it in my first book, the Sacred Geometry Design Source Book. Although I refer to that frequently when the topic comes up of not wanting to change the world but seeing through the illusion, and that is the stereograms that were popularized a few decades ago in these magic eye posters. Probably a lot of people are familiar with those. If you focus on the plane of the apparent form of these posters, all you see is just a bunch of random shapes and dots and squiggles and whatnot, and that has no meaning. Well, of course, and the metaphor falls apart a little bit because really nothing in this world has meaning. But to complete the metaphor, on these magic eye posters, if you actually look past or beyond the plane of the paper, if your eyes focus, at like 2 or 3 inches, something like that, past the plane, the way the stereogram, aka magic eye posters, for an example, work is that. Your eyes then see the stereoscopic image that is encoded in those graphics, and suddenly you see whether it's animals or in the book that I did, I had a half a dozen geometric figures of stellated dodecahedra that suddenly appeared when you look at that page in the reference section of the back of the book. But you can make a stereogram by recognizing that there's a potential to see beyond the random chaotic stuff and see patterns emerge, and there's software that does that, and I found a piece of software that did it, but I think it's a cool metaphor. If you Google stereogram, you'll find all kinds of examples on it, and you just have to look. In the case of when you bring them up on your computer, you look past the screen of your computer a couple of inches or so, and you kind of it's not like you're defocusing altogether, but you're just focusing on something that's slightly past the plane of that you believe that you're on metaphorically, and suddenly this image is like, wow. And the first time you get that, I remember I was one of many who when those first came out, I said, oh, I don't see it, and then finally someone said, oh, you just have to look past, beyond. It's not like the photons aren't hitting your retina. It's just that they're converging in a different way, and that has a meaning that's deeper, farther, more profound. And suddenly, whoop, the image appears. There it is. And it's pretty cool.
And you know what's really interesting about that? I know I've mentioned this before, but because I only have one eye, not like I'm a cyclops, an eye in the middle of the forehead, but because I don't have binocular vision, I don't see those. I used to see them when I could see with both eyes, but I don't see those now. And
right,
I think there's tremendous metaphor in that. I'm writing about that right now, because, Jesus, in the Bible, it says, if thine eye be single, then you can see, the truth or see the Christ or, see heaven. And I've looked for a lot of metaphor in my vision situation, since, there has to be a meaning to it or else it wouldn't be happening to me. But it must be special, but that you do have to, in order to see, the illusion as real, you do have to look at it from two different points of view. And so if you only have one reference point, one point of view, then you don't see that particular illusion. And so I think it's a real handy kind of metaphor because it does take two. In order to see the illusion, there must be a subject and an object.
Right.
And if there's not two, if there's only one, then that has really, it loses all of its meaning. And, other than as a metaphor of, that's not the truth. And so, and it's interesting. It is very interesting to me, because I'm writing a book now about my life. And in the book, I'm seeing all the metaphors through my life that have been, I mean, very pointed and specific to show me the truth about what I am. I just feel so blessed for that. And, you know, of course, thank God for, you know, Jesus and A Course in Miracles and Gary Renard and Bruce Rawls and all the, you know, those outside of me that seem to be, you know, showing me something that I need to see about myself. It really, what a great classroom this is. I love it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So I'm going to review the first step in forgiveness. Okay. To review the first step in forgiveness, you have to catch yourself thinking with the ego and stop it. That's old Bob Newhart. Stop it.
Exactly. I was just thinking of that. I have that clip on ACIM blog for that reason, just because I think it's so fun and profound and in a silly way.
Absolutely. It's beautiful. And if you just did that, if you never went to a psychologist, you never read Byron Katie, you never did anything, and you just hit that stop it button, it would shift everything for you eventually, because it takes time to wear down. Just like for me when I lost my eye. You know, when I lost my eye, it was, you would think, you know, people were, you know, like, oh my God, you must be devastated, you know, must be terrible. I was not devastated. It didn't seem terrible to me. It was very inconvenient, and I didn't like it not to be able to see. And it took a long time for me to be able to adjust, but the brain is amazing in its ability to repurpose and build new neural nets to give you, you know, to make up for what you seem to have lost. So for me, learning to live with only one eye was just a tremendous adjustment, but it also was a tremendous education to me because I began to see how I was looking at things. Of course, I wouldn't have been open to that had I not had this mind training that I don't think I would have. I don't know, because I didn't have it. It wasn't that way. But if I didn't have the mind training of A Course in Miracles, I would probably have been just utterly devastated. But for me, it became a symbol and a gift to show me that what I thought I was seeing was not really there. And, you know, what a gift, you know, losing the eye, what a gift. So just remember that, losing my balance, it was a gift. Everything that's happened to me, you know, I'm not saying like, you know, I'm going to make the best of it and it's a silver lining. I'm saying that is the truth, and thank God it was shown to me in that way, because I must be so hard-headed that you have to just literally remove the thing that I'm depending on in order for me to be able to recognize that I don't need it. But anyway, that's me. I'm stubborn. Okay. to review the first step in forgiveness, you have to catch yourself thinking with the ego and stop it. That takes discipline, because the ego is very clever, and it will come up with 1,000 different ways to convince you that you and others are bodies, which makes the whole thing true. Yet to repeat the Holy Spirit has a totally different identity for you to remember. Quote, I am not a body, I am free, for I am still as God created me. End quote. Many times in A Course in Miracles it says this. That's my insert. This also applies to others and the second step in forgiveness involves an understanding that what you're seeing is not true, and you need to change your mind and think with the Holy Spirit instead of the ego. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, if you get that, if you can do that, even be open enough to do that, or that's my thought. It's been my experience. I can't say it works for everyone. But I have a feeling that if you let it, it would. And it just makes a huge, huge difference in everything. So I'm not a body. I'm free. I'm still as God created me. And nothing that this body does has any effect or impact on what I am.
Exactly, exactly. And I think the next couple of paragraphs, which are short, I'll read a couple, relate to what you were just sharing, is that, you know, if you can take all the specific situations and if you can apply them to that undoing process in the mind and releasing yourself from the condemnation and from the judgment that the ego wants to inflict, that is very freeing. So I'll continue. It says, if you make it that far, the Holy Spirit will give you the right-minded ideas from the Course that are best for you to apply to the situation or event you find yourself involved in. In your case, it might be your physical vision. Or you may not have to think at all. You may simply find yourself at peace. Eventually, as the ego is undone and the Holy Spirit begins to dominate your mind, you'll be able to hear the messages and inspiration that come from the Holy Spirit more clearly. You can even receive answers to the practical questions you have about how to proceed with your illusory life. A life lived with the Holy Spirit is a totally different experience than one lived with the ego. Now you're never alone, even if you're the only person in the room. What a great metaphor for what we're doing right now. We probably, to see somebody who walks into the rooms where we're sitting, thinks, oh, well, there's Bruce is in a room by himself and Lynn's in a room by herself. But no, we actually are sharing this not only with each other, but with the entire cosmos and certainly everybody who happens to be listening live and who might be listening to this in the future from the recording. But, you know, we have the opportunity to see that we're all in it together, and we have a direct and palpable experience of that connection. And I think that's part of the immediate benefit of forgiveness, is that we forgive ourselves for our projections. And as today's workbook lesson that I was reading this morning reminds us, you know, every one that you forgive becomes a part of your new. And, well, it's not really new, but your restored identity, because I'm paraphrasing greatly, of course, but that's what I got from one of the things I got from reading it is that, you know, every time we let go of our belief in separation and differences and thinking that, you know, well, I'm, you know, better or worse than someone else, or I'm different, or, you know, my needs are special and unique, or, you know, all that stuff. Whenever we loosen our mind's grip on that, we become truly closer and eternally intimate with the rest of the cosmos, including all that appear to inhabit it. So that's kind of cool, isn't it?
I guess it works if I mute my mic. It is very cool. And I'm just going to read this from Lesson 350, because this is just so profound. Mm-hmm. And if you understood, if you knew this, it would shift everything, I think. I mean, it, really, that what we perceive, what we forgive becomes a part of us as we perceive ourselves.
Exactly.
The Son of God incorporates all things within himself as you created him. Your memory depends on his forgiveness. What he is unaffected by his thoughts, but what he looks upon is their direct result. Therefore, my Father, I would turn to you. Only your memory will set me free, and only my forgiveness teaches me to let your memory return to me and give it to the world in thankfulness. So this forgiveness is so essential, because as we forgive things, we do recognize our oneness with it. We do recognize that there is no separation. We do recognize that we are one. And that is everything. It's just, what an incredible gift forgiveness is.
It really is.
I'm going to take a real quick break if you want to continue to read on.
Sure. While you're doing that, I'm going to just comment briefly that you know, that we're all in the same choir, both literally and figuratively sometimes. Okay. So I'll continue on. This is page 28, Roman numeral 28, in the A Note from the Author about A Course in Miracles. This is in Gary Renard's fourth book, which Lynn and I have been reading from, if you're just joining us. The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. So anyway, Gary goes on. to say, your unconscious mind knows everything. It would have to, because that's where the projection of a universe of time and space is coming from in the first place. And if it knows everything, it knows that there's really just one of us. And if it knows there's really just one of us, it will interpret whatever you think about the world or another person to really be about you. That's a pretty sobering thought. Kind of like the old cliche of when you point the finger at someone else, you've got three pointed back at yourself, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, really they're all pointed back. Okay. So people wonder why they're depressed, but just look at the garbage they've been thinking about other people their whole lives without realizing it was really just going to them and would determine how they feel about themselves and ultimately even establish their own identity as they would see it and believe it is. It's all about identity, isn't it? And the ego's identity is always fragmented and separate and pretty pathetic and miserable, actually, as, of course, points out so eloquently. So another important aspect of the second step of forgiveness is that you understand you are forgiving the other person, not because they've really done something, because they haven't really done anything, because you're the one who made them up in the first place. So you're forgiving that person because they haven't really done anything. That's why they're innocent. This kind of forgiveness leads to a re-imaging of yourself. If they're guilty, you're guilty. But if they're innocent, you're innocent. So simple, huh? There's no way around it. That's because of a very important law of the mind that is articulated in ACIM. As you see him, you will see yourself. In that last sentence in quotes. So, yeah, a lot of just fundamental course thinking in that paragraph, isn't there?
It is. And fortunately, I could hear you the whole time. So
okay. Oh, good.
So, what perfect logic this paragraph is. I mean, mm-hmm. This is perfect logic. You can tell this to anyone, and, you know, maybe after a little discussion and, you know, they may be, you know, resistant or whatever, but you could tell this to anyone and they would, if they have any kind of reason in their mind, would say, you know what, that kind of makes sense, because it does.
Right. And we all have the reason and we all have the resistance. Which is why, you know, Ken Wapnick says, you know, it's a three-part system that everyone shares, which is why we're all in the same boat. We all have a decision-making faculty in our mind, and we all have an insane thought system of the ego that doesn't resonate with this, that complains bitterly with its resistance to saying, well, no, I'm the victim of yada yada. And, you know, so whenever the slightest twinge of victimhood or martyrdom rears its ugly head, you can pretty much figure your ego is trying to, you know, sabotage that inner peace. And so we just have to be vigilant for that. And obviously the other part is the sane part of the mind, which we call Holy Spirit or the Jesus of A Course in Miracles, or I like to say our inner kindness teacher, that leads us gently away from those misinterpretations and really translates the experience we have in the script of our lives into a forgiveness classroom that's gentle and leads us rapidly and very effectively away from the fear. So,
absolutely. And I'm going to read this next paragraph. Because this is really important stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in fact, this is like the essential. I'm reading this and I'm like, yes, this is exactly what happens. He says, yet it's vital at the same time that you do not stop there, as many students do. There's another very important part to all of this that most never consider. If it's true that as you see him, you will see yourself, and if you go through life thinking the world and people are just illusions, your mind will interpret it to mean that you are an illusion. That will leave you feeling empty and meaningless, which is a pretty good description of depression. That's why A Course in Miracles is a lot more proactive than most people realize. It doesn't just describe the thought system of the ego, which is the thought system of most of the world. It completely replaces the thought system of the ego with the thought system of the Holy Spirit. So it's imperative that you combine the third step of forgiveness with the first two. And this is where people get, they get to this place where, okay, well, I'm forgiving, and not recognizing that it's not just a decision on my part to forgive. It's allowing my entire thought system to be replaced. Mm-hmm. And it's not a scary thing either, because the thought system that replaces it is amazing.
Absolutely.
It's so comforting. It's so loving. You know, I think if people who are addicted to drugs, you know, heroin, opiates, if that's going on so much right now, what are people doing? They're looking for this peace of mind and this comfort and this feeling of warmth and love and being accepted and unconditionally loved. This is what people are looking for. And, you know, a drug that sedates part of the body mind and gives us a feeling of warmth and fuzzy love and everything, even temporarily, can seem so inviting. Believe me, I've been, you know, when I was, you know, had, you know, surgeries and accidents and things like that, you know, been given these kind of drugs, and the feeling of euphoria that comes over you, the feeling of safety and calm that comes over you when your body is sedated in that way is just wonderful. Of course we want to feel that way, but it's temporary because, you know, the drug wears off, the body comes back, the mind comes back. But with this system, with the Holy Spirit's thought system, it doesn't wear off. The mind doesn't come back. The body doesn't come back. The fear is eliminated. There's no fear. It's only love and joy. And that feeling is there immediately, constantly, anytime. You know, if I start feeling afraid, if I start feeling worried, if I start feeling sad, all I have to do is just forgive, remember the truth. And it's not denial. I'm not denying what's happening. I'm just looking at it from a different point of view. And it's like you're looking at the, planet Mercury from a distance. You know, if you stood on the planet Mercury, it would be probably instantaneous, you know, you would be like evaporated. But from a distance, you can look at it and not be touched by it because you see what it is, but it doesn't involve you. You see what appears to be suffering in the world, but you recognize that, you know, all these lives that are being led are me trying to find my reality and my truth. All this suffering that appears to be is me trying to see beyond this world. And when I recognize that and allow the Holy Spirit to change my mind about it, I can be at peace with it. You know, not because, you know, I'm turning a blind eye to your suffering, but because I recognize that the suffering is a projection of my own mind. I'm the one who thinks you're suffering. I think your suffering is much worse than you think your suffering is. No matter how much you think you're suffering, if I'm suffering over your suffering, I'm going to exaggerate it. I'm going to see it as worse. I'm going to see it as unbearable, and I'm going to be afraid because I'm interpreting something that is not there. So anyway, that's the end of that rant.
Well, just to you know, tie into what you were just sharing, and this wonderful paragraph suggests, is that, you know, that I like the three R's metaphor of the three steps in forgiveness, which is reveal, release, and replace. And I find that, I'll speak for myself, that in times past when I haven't really completely forgiven myself, it's because I've revealed perhaps a portion of my investment in the ego, but usually I haven't really fully released the investment in it. And if it's just an intellectual, say, oh yeah, well there it is. But if I'm still, you know, mucking around in that thought system and, you know, just jumping right back into that with, you know, because of the resistance of the ego, and a lack of really practice and mind discipline, then I'm not going to allow the replacement, which is the third step. So that replacement step is, as Gary points out here, vital, because we have to replace what doesn't work with what does, and what really does truly not just satisfy it on a temporary basis, but truly fulfill us on an internal basis for us to want to continue to make that switch over, to make that transition between the insanity of the ego and the sanity of the Holy Spirit. We have to be identified with it willingly, of our own free will and accord, as the cliche goes, because that's the only thing that will truly satisfy us. But we have to be convinced. We have to just demonstrate for ourselves that is what truly makes us happy. And it's not something that's outside of ourselves. It's our decision in the mind of allowing our inner kindness teacher to replace the nonsense, we made up as egos with the truly sustainable reason and logic, and not just intellectually, but on a fulfilling feeling level, the true comfort that comes from recognizing our innocence is identical to the innocence of everyone else, and we can't leave anyone out. So, let me read. I think we've got enough time to read the next paragraph or two, which really kind of complete this thought. The biggest mistake A Course in Miracles students, as well as other spiritual students, make when it comes to forgiveness is that they don't go all the way with it. Their forgiveness is too limited. That brings up the third step in forgiveness, which is based on the oneness of spirit rather than the chaos of an unstable and seemingly separate world. This is spiritual sight. You learn to see the way the Holy Spirit sees, and thus get in touch with what you really are. The Holy Spirit sees the love and innocence of spirit everywhere. And I love what Gary's Fearless Love audio suggests in an exercise, is seeing all of spirit in everyone, and not just part of it. And I think that is really what starts, the light that starts peeking through the cracks and ego's armaments and its shields of oblivion begins to happen when we let go of the insanity of the ego's interpretation. And then it's inevitable that the light that breaks through those cracks in the mind, so to speak, is that we see that everyone is all of spirit and completely innocent. Not in spite of appearances, but it's almost like, again, we're looking through and beyond the appearances, because we realize that they don't have anything to do with reality. We don't deny the photons and the waves that come into our ears and all that kind of stuff, but we just deny the ego's interpretation of them. And then the paragraph concludes with, in fact, the Course says, wherever he looks, he sees himself. And that's with capital H's everywhere in that sentence. And that the capital H, himself, ourself, is the all-inclusive self that the Holy Spirit suggests as our identity that's been there all along, that we've just covered over with a lot of misinformation from an ego investment. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. And that is really, I wanted to just point out, when you look at the lessons of the Holy Spirit, and it says, to have, give all to all, really that's what it's saying. You can't have all of Christhood unless you give everyone else all of Christhood.
Exactly.
Everyone is the same. And so you can't hold any part of it to yourself or think, just because this person did this or they act this way or they look this way, that somehow or the other you can't give them their holiness as the Christ, because that is what they are. And Dove posts on the board, understanding totality, totally. I mean, that's basically what it is. trying to understand anything less is not understandable. Yeah, that's it. It's not possible. So this is essential to understand. To have, give all to all means all, everything. You can't hold back and say, yeah, but they're not ready, or, they're, this, or they did this, or, no. If you can't give 100% Holy Spirit mind, to all, then you're holding back. And that exercise that you talk about is, which was transformative to me, as I did listen to that many, many times.
Yeah.
Okay, and I don't see Devin and Barb yet, so I don't think. So I'm going to go ahead and read the next paragraph.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Thus, the third step is what my teachers call spiritual sight, and what the Course also describes not only as vision with a capital B, but as true perception. You can change your own, you change your own experience, and ultimately what you believe is your own identity by changing the way you think about and identify other people. As the Course tells us, next page, in the final section of the text, choose once again what you would have him be, remembering that every choice you make establishes your own identity as you will see it and believe it is. This is why it's vital, and that's a quote from the Course. This is why it's vital to remember that the Holy Spirit doesn't think in terms of separation. The Holy Spirit thinks in terms of wholeness and the oneness of spirit. Spiritual sight involves the way you think. With spiritual sight, you overlook the body as well as the idea of individuality and think outside of the box. You think of that person not just as being part of the whole, but as being all of it. And that exercise is, they're not just part of the whole, they are all, they are the whole.
Exactly.
They are what is.
Yeah. And that's all innocence too, that everything and everyone becomes infused and we recognize the truth that their essence is that innocence, that perfect eternal innocence that we never left, they never left, and we're all in that really wonderful awareness together. And that's what is the quality of that awareness is something that really motivates us as we get little glimpses of it to continue on and to want to overcome the resistance and to replace, allow Holy Spirit to replace, because we don't do it. It's really, that's the third step, is we just get the heck out of the way in the forgiveness process and allow Holy Spirit to replace our insanity after we reveal and release that investment in the insanity. And the Holy Spirit just replaces it. That's the third R, and that's really all we need to do is just allow at that point, and that's pretty cool. Thank you, Lynn, as always. I always enjoy these conversations we have on Saturday mornings, and I'm always reachable through acimblog.com, and I've got a link to this book we've been reading from, along with other titles that might be of interest to Course students there, and just as a little quick plug, I always like to say, if you purchase things that are Course related from that site, I get a little affiliate commission, which is always helpful. But the price is the same to you, and I also like to share other conversations with other Course students and teachers, and so I always appreciate the feedback and the support, and certainly all the contributions that everybody here on ACM Gather is making, and beyond. So have a great week, everyone, and thanks and love to all.
All right, and thank you so much, Bruce. And I want to remind everyone that I will be appearing at the at the Course in Miracles conference in February in San Francisco, that's put on by the Community Miracle Center, along with my partner Dove Fishman. We are team teaching there, and so please, if you consider coming to the conference, please join us. And if you do, I think the website is miracles-center.org. And if you come in and join us, let them know that we were the ones that suggested it, and we'll maybe get invited back next year is what the hope is. But we're doing that. And then over Columbus Day weekend, John Mundy is having a workshop in Stony Point, New York. I don't have the details right now, but I will send you a link to that to put on your blog. But I will also be appearing there, and we're going to have a little reunion of folks who are ACIM Gather people, hopefully, on Columbus Day in Stony Point, New York. So if you're on the East Coast or if you can travel out there, it'd be kind of fun to get to see some of the other folks who join us here on ACIM Gather for A Course in Miracles. So once again, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And I'm looking forward to the time when we see each other again. I'm sure it will be soon.
I'm certain of it. It's inevitable, as they say. As we say.
Okay, we'll be together. All right. I love you, Bruce, and I'll talk to you
Likewise.
Next week.
Have a great week, all.
All right. Bye-bye.